This is Freiburg New Church Assembly on Saturday, August 7th, 2004, and this is the first lecture. I'm Reverend F. Robert Toffel, known often as F. Bob, and my subject today is the Seven Churches of Asia. We've been studying spiritual geography, the principle Emanuel Swedenborg set forth that the different tribes and countries and the different people, but also the hills and the valleys, the rivers and the seas, and all the places represent and correspond to, in some way, our inner spiritual state, and sometimes changes there too. Thursday, I talked about the River Jordan and how there was a big change when the children of Israel went across the river and the waters heaped up, and they went across on dry ground with the Ark of the Covenant leading them. And this certainly changed the representation, if not the geography itself. Other lectures have dealt with the changes of leadership and the pattern of judges and the way the tribes would work, and then the kings and the United Kingdom, the divided kingdom. And Lee yesterday noted, I think I got what he said right, but it's a good thought anyway, I think. He said it's not so much that the idea of a king was a bad idea to begin with, but they had to move on. That was close to what it was, but with where Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world," and so that was a little minor change in thought. This morning, I've taken up my subject as the seven churches in Asia, and that would represent another transition in my mind from the holy center of Jerusalem to the outermosts, actual places of the churches. And there were other churches, but seven was taken to be a complete number of all the different problems the churches could have. So we'll be pushing the envelope a little bit to during the time of Nero, around the 40, 41, 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. I mean, they didn't necessarily have it all written down just right. Persecution in Jerusalem led to the church going, some of the people, Philip and others, going over to Samaria, people going different places and going upward, and they went north, young man. And this is going to be like a juxtaposition. It's going to be using an old map, but the seas, you know, and land masses are pretty much where they are in the the waters, the blue stuff. So over here in Canaan would be Jerusalem, somewhere around there. The Dead Sea is known there. And so the church went up around the corner, up into what is now Turkey. And Ankara and Istanbul would be somewhere up there. And I was trying to get oriented, and Rome would be here. And I'm told that, I guess, this landmass here is where up where my ancestors would be, in Germany and Paris and places like that. But essentially, the seven churches were over there. Ephesus was something like 3 miles from the sea, wasn't it? And then, bing, 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 there was a road from Tarsus to Philadelphia. And that was one of the crossroads that the churches were on. I'm not going to go into the details about that because I don't have them firmly fixed in my mind. So the seven churches to Asia represent, on a literal level, the various aspects of a church in general and particular. Paul was not the only one to move Christianity beyond the bounds of Jerusalem and Judaism. You may remember, had the controversy as he went out to the Gentiles. There were all the different rites and so forth of Judaism, circumcision being one of them, and all the different aspects of the law and what was clean and unclean. Peter had a similar experience in the 10th chapter of Acts, where a centurion was asking him to come from where he was staying in Joppa to Caesarea. Those who will not learn geography are condemned to be confused. I'm not sure where Caesarea is. I'm not sure whether it was over there. I think it was sort of over there. Huh? Well, in any event, Joppa was more or less over there, and he was invited by the centurion in a vision, and the centurion wanted him to come and talk to him in Caesarea, and Peter wasn't quite sure he should do that because of all this clean and unclean stuff, and so there was the vision of all the animals being brought up in a sheet, and the message was, those that God has made clean, you shall not call unclean. We don't know too much about the author John. I'm going to say a little bit because it is controversial. He simply calls himself John, and that's about all we really know about the author. There are three letters of John in the New Testament, and there's the Gospel, of course, and then there's the Book of Revelation. And most accepted scholarship is that probably they were not written, all five items, by the same hand. Probably different people. And to advance the argument that the apostle or disciple John wrote them all, you'd have to push the time of these letters we're talking about preparing for the tribulation, which was persecution under Rome, and the second coming. You'd have to push the persecutions back into Nero's time only, whereas most people think that the generally accepted time of the persecutions was after the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, and AD 96 was when they think that Domitian was. But you've got two church fathers. One said it was Justin Martyr said it was the apostle, and Irenaeus says it wasn't. So you can take your choice. But it's pretty clear to me, at least. I accept the idea that these letters were written to seven churches. There were more at the time. They were remnants from Paul's journeys and from other people's work in that area as they went up from Jerusalem beyond the time of the persecution to escape the persecution in Jerusalem. Now, another tidbit is that Nero confined most of his persecution, we think, to Jerusalem, but Domitian extended it over to this Asia Minor area. So there's a lot of reasons to think that it was a different John. It was a divine commission, and as you read it devotionally, you can't escape the thought that this is the Lord Jesus Christ addressing every reader, and it's like a wake-up call. It's like everyone has aspects. If you were in the military, it'd be like a general inspection. You know, time gets ready and someone's going to be coming, and they learn different parts of stuff because they get advanced knowledge of what's going to be asked and this kind of a thing. And it's like, you know, shape up is the call. And it was particularly addressed to people who thought that the second coming of Christ was going to be within their generation right soon. And Swedenborg gives us the idea that when it says these things will have to take place soon, means they will surely take place. And we'll be addressing the idea of persecution in a minute. They follow a pattern. There's the salutation that we read this morning, the address of John to the churches in Asia, and the salutation, grace be unto you and peace. And then the 22nd chapter, where the invitation is, you know, let those who are thirsty come, and let everyone come to the waters of life. And sandwiched in between are seven visions and seven sections that the author uses as a way. And they all start with a commendation, which is good psychologically to start with something good that someone has done, and then say, well, this is something that's not so good, but you know, overall it's okay, and then come on back. So there's the commendation, I know your deeds, in each of the letters. And then there's a rebuke, if applicable, except for Smyrna and Philadelphia. They were they were doing the best they could, and they didn't do anything really bad. So there isn't a rebuke for them. And then there's a commendation, except for Laodicea and Pergamum. But to all of them, there's the call, who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says. And to the one that overcomes, there will be a promise. And they're the seven promises, and they recapitulate. You know, there's the hidden manna, there's the paradise. It follows in order there. Eat of the tree of tree of life, watered by the river. That's goes back to Eden. The hidden manna will give authority over the nations. We'll walk dressed in white. We'll have be given a white stone on which a new name is written, and eventually we'll sit with Christ on His throne. Now, these are all, this is all very well and good, and this is what we actually have in common with Christianity generally, that these are seven letters. They don't hit all of them. Colossae isn't mentioned, and there's no doubt others, but seven. Swedenborg recapitulates in the Potts Concordance in Apocalypse Revealed. Most of the items are from that. Seven is a completeness, and all the things that could go wrong in a person's life devoted to following the Lord Jesus Christ as sovereign and king would be found there. And we can go through them in a minute. But as I flip the pages, I mentioned last time they're big type. It's 18-point type because I need it that way. So don't get thinking that there's that much. But as I reread the author's preface to Apocalypse Revealed, it really struck me that this is a very concise way of really speaking about how this movement out, first the movement out to from Jerusalem and Judaism to the Gentiles, and then this is to everybody in the Christian churches, but we also understand that it's a call to all the nations, and that everybody of every religion that is following their religion is saved by the Lord. Now, Swedenborg starts, it's really cool. He starts right where it is. He says, there are many people who've labored in the explanation of the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, but as the spiritual sense has been hitherto unknown, they could not see the spiritual and heavenly arcana that lie within, for the spiritual sense alone discloses this. On which account, expositors have conjectured various things, and most of them have applied the things in the book to the states of empires intermingling with ecclesiastical affairs. But the Apocalypse, like the whole word, in its spiritual sense, treats of worldly, not of worldly, but of heavenly things. Thus, it speaks not of empires and kingdoms, but of heaven and the church. After the last judgment, and this is where he just goes right out, I mean, this is as Swedenborgians, we've got these controversial ideas that they're no more controversial than some of the ideas I come across. After the last judgment, which was accomplished in the spiritual world in the year 1757, that means in our time, 1757, he witnessed the separations and removals taking place. There was formed a new heaven from Christians, but from those only who could receive the Lord as the God of heaven and earth, where Jesus said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, and who at the same time in the world had repented of their evil works. From this heaven made up of Christians, a new church, which is the New Jerusalem, is descending and will descend. So the new church comes from the Christian church in heaven. Things come from heaven first. At least that's Swedenborg's idea. That there is to be a new heaven and new church on earth will descend as manifest from the idea of, I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, descending, and there was no more sea. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And he who was seated on the throne said, I'm making all things new. And write this down. The new heaven, then, is a new heaven from the Christians. And the New Jerusalem is the new church on earth, which will act as one with that heaven. So this new church was going a time before Swedenborg. To this, something will be added for illustration. The Christian heaven is below the ancient heavens. Into it, from the time of the Lord when he was in the world, were admitted those who worshiped one God under three persons, because that was known in the whole Christian world. But they who cherished no other idea of the Lord's human than that of the human of another person could not receive the faith in the New Jerusalem, which is that the Lord is the only God in whom is the Trinity. These were for that reason separated and were sent away to the extremes, and that was the last judgment that he saw. So there was a change in the heavens in these 1,700 years since the time of the Lord. And these Christians coming into heaven, then there was a time they had to be sifted and sorted. For the whole heaven is founded upon a just idea of God, or we could say an accurate or appropriate idea of God. Since by that idea there is conjunction, and by conjunction light, wisdom, and eternal happiness. And Swedenborg will say every other places that every doctrine comes from our idea of God. So everything hangs on to the idea of God, whether there's a wrathful God or a loving God, whether there's a God that's like the deist's God, or there's the incarnate God that Christians believe. Everyone can see that the apocalypse can by no means be explained but by the Lord alone, for each word therein contains arcana which could never be known. And then he said, "Do not believe, therefore, that I have taken anything therein from myself, nor from any angel, but from the Lord alone." And so with that as a backdrop, he talks about the address to the not just the seven churches in which represent everything that could go wrong to the faithful and not so faithful followers of the Lord, but people of all time. These seven churches represent every age of people. So the churches proceed in order. I've got it in a better place over here. Ephesus is an active church that was sound in their doctrine, but as it says, I know your deeds. I have this against you. You have forsaken your first love. So the idea of Christian love was lacking. They got too much concerned about the right doctrine. This can happen in any church. It could possibly even happen in the Swedenborgian church. So those who primarily regard truths of doctrine and not goods of life who are meant by the church of Ephesus. Then Smyrna is the persecuted church, the poor but rich church. It had low self-esteem because of its affliction. They thought they were poor, and yet in the Lord's eyes they were very rich because they were holding fast. And just more encouragement, do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. It's sort of like cheer up, things are going to get worse. I mean, it's hard. But whoever hears what the Spirit says to the churches and overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. And then Pergamum or Pergamos, there's probably a linguistic reason for the different names. The compromising church or the heretical church. He says, I know where you live. You've heard that before, right? Someone comes after you for collections. We know where you live. You live where Satan has his throne. And there's some that think that might refer to the fact that there was the first temple dedicated to Augustus. And the Roman Empire. You did not renounce your faith in me, even the days of Antipas. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. There's people there that hold to the teaching of Balaam. And that goes back to the Israelites sinning, eating food sacrificed to idols, and sexual immorality. Repent, I will come soon and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. But those who overcome, they'll be given a white stone with a new name written. And Swedenborg in Apocalypse Revealed says this is those who place the all of the church in good works and not anything in truths are meant by the Pergamos. So, you know, it's just do the right thing. It really doesn't matter why or what your reason might be. Not particularly helpful. It's important for psychological congruence, but what Swedenborg calls correspondence is for our heart and mind to be together in our action, all three of them, like the three legs of a milking stool. Thyatira, the corrupt church, the church of the false prophetess, again, sexual immorality and eating food sacrificed to the gods. Hold on to what you do have. The rest of you do not hold to those teachings of Satan. And so, in parenthesis, I will not impose any other burden on you. Only hold fast to what you have until I come. To the one that overcomes, I will give authority over the nations. I also give them the morning star. Those who are in faith from charity and also who are in faith separated from charity are meant by the church in Thyatira. So there's this mixture, and we need to sort that out and keep together. Now, the dying church in Sardis. The angel of the church in Sardis, I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead. Wake up! That's what it says. Strengthen what remains, for I have not found your deeds complete. Whoever overcomes will be dressed in white and will not be blotted out from the book of life. Those who are in dead worship without charity and faith, and that's just going through the motions. You know, going to church on Sunday and then going home and then that's it. That can be okay, but I mean, it unless there's the application, you know, going from the Sunday Jerusalem church down to the Jericho times. The faithful church, Philadelphia. I've set an open door which no one can. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. So the Lord sets an open door there, and if you have an open door policy, that's like living in a goldfish bowl. You just have to do what's right. So that's what they've been doing that, though. Since you've kept my command to endure patiently, I'll keep you from the hour of trial that's going to come upon the whole world. Again, hold fast to what you have, and I will make you a pillar in the temple. Those who are in truth from good from the Lord are described by the church in Philadelphia. So that's the part of ourselves that's on the right track, and it's the part of any church that's doing what's right. And then we come lastly to the church that Pop Wolf mentioned earlier in the week, Laodicea, the lukewarm church that's only good to be spewed out of the mouth. You know, if you're thirsty and you get some lukewarm water, it's not too good. I mean, it's pretty bad. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so that you can become rich, and white clothes to wear so you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put in your eyes so you can see. I stand at the door and knock. And that's a good way to end up this. The Lord, of course, knows what's infinitely wise, but we see that in the fact that the Lord says, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come in to eat with him and he with me. And to all who overcome, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne. And the lukewarm church, then, are those who alternately believe from themselves and from the word, and thus profane holy things are described by this. And we all have the potential to do that, and in some ways I think we do that. Sometimes we believe from ourselves, we figure things out, and sometimes we have to because the directions aren't clear. You know, the Lord leaves us in freedom here. We have to kind of figure things out. But if we ask the Lord for help before we try to figure things out, it usually goes better. I said I'd talk a little bit about persecutions, and what about persecutions at the present day? Anybody? Are people persecuted for their faith? They are. Some are beheaded. Ethnic cleansing. The trouble in the Baltics. You know, Christianity and Islam, or part of Islam. Genocide, what's going on over in Sudan. Countries in which Christianity is not the dominant faith, or in which it is the dominant faith, and you can't just sort things out along that idea. But these days, in countries that do not value the separation of the church and the state, who have theocracies, it goes hard for somebody in those kind of countries. And we see it every night on the evening news. Another kind of persecution. Oh, come on, everybody else is doing it. Isn't that a kind of a persecution of peer pressure? It puts a pressure on you. It's kind of a go along, get along by going along. Swedenborg very often refers to the hellish crew. I mean, he's very graphic, right? But that's the whole force of the demonic. If Christians from the time of the Lord have been going into the Christian heaven, and then there was a sorting out, what was happening on the other side? What do we call it when a person is a pathological? You know, people that won't be reformed. I mean, the Lord has the idea that everybody can be reformed, and that's one thing that we have, is that everybody, I mean, there's probably inertia that's going to make it hard for some. They've made it difficult for themselves because they've gone through a life of conning and deceit and cheating and getting things easier. So it's going to be harder for them, but I mean, it's still possible. But the temptations of every sort that come upon us are a form of persecution. I mean, we don't want to get a complex over it. We don't want to say we've got a persecution complex. But the seven letters to the seven churches speak to every person of every time, thus to you and me. And so the voice of the risen Christ is calling call to wake up, to the become alive to the spiritual realities in new ways. I mean, we hopefully go along on an upward path of plateaus, and maybe there'll be hills and valleys that we'll hear about in the next hour. But I don't want to leave without going on the idea of the prophetic tradition of judgment. The woes that are pronounced by the prophets and the judgments can be looked at as a sign of hope, because these judgments weren't given to nations that weren't going to be part of the total picture, part of the Lord's kingdom. So the idea of those whom I love I rebuke and chasten, the idea of the prophetic judgment is a sign of hope. It's a good idea. If someone's saying, you know, F. Bob, let's you and I talk for a minute, or anybody. You know, when people take us aside and want to help us, it's usually because we may not have seen some aspect of ourselves. There's a window of feedback and self-revelation that many of you may know about, and maybe you don't. Either way, what's Zorba the Greek say? You want to hear a story? I'll tell you one anyway. Oh, this is a confusing thing. There we go. Well, it turns out that there was there were these people named Joe and Harry. And they were probably these group dynamics people that George was talking about earlier. And they came up with this idea, and it's been a long time since I had it. I hope I get it right. Maybe someone will. That's one thing about Freiburg that I like, is that people will either, gently or not so gently, whatever, it doesn't matter. Persecute. I get persecuted a lot because I make misstatements and I do things funny. So I don't know where to draw me and you on the diagram to get this, but this is aspects that you know about me, and I know about me, and I know you know about me, and you know that I know about me. This is common knowledge of ourselves. I mean, you know, people say, well, F-Bomb's that kind of a person. He's kind of loud, or he's this, or whatever. And I don't know whether over or up or down, what's better. But you don't know everything about me that I know about me, and you don't know everything I know. There's a part to me that you don't know. I mean, you may think you know. I mean, and that's true of anybody. I mean, the same way with you, Ken, wouldn't it be?
Let's not get into that.
But don't bite surface. I won't bite. But I would bet that most of you would agree that there are aspects to yourself that you know, but other people don't know. And then there's something over here. Oh, being smart. See, F. Bob likes to be smart. Trying to put you know, and it should have been YOU. But you know about me some things that I don't know about myself. I mean, would that some grace the gift give us to know ourselves as others see us? That's close. And that was, I guess there was this lady went into church with all her finery and had a bug on her hat or bonnet or something. So there are different ways that you could share what you know about me. I mean, you could say, Bob, did you ever know that, you really bug people when you do this, that, or the other? Well, I mean, that might be okay if I were feeling in an insular mood and didn't feel too bad that day. But if you can give me feedback about myself in a way that I can accept it and use it and integrate it into myself, then that's good. And my relationships with other people would probably go a little bit better if I could give a little bit of self-revelation. If I could say, you know what, if I'm standing up there and I'm frowning, or if I'm staring off in space, I'm really not, you know, taking your inventory or anything. I'm just maybe thinking, or who knows, it might even be a seizure. There's places over here, though, that you don't go there. I mean, you know, you can get, I mean, in the best of us, there's the old brain kind of stuff, and but in any event, we can have a bigger picture of ourselves. I don't know how to draw 3D. I guess you should be able to draw 3D, so that we know more about ourselves, and we're on our way to. That's a form of regeneration, I think, to know more about ourselves and be able to do better. Well, big as the print was, I've come to an end. I hope this has been helpful. It's one of the most exciting parts to me, especially as I reread that preface of Swedenborg to and just to realize that, you know, we weren't the Church of the New Jerusalem didn't spring full blown out of the forehead of Zeus, was it? But the idea that Swedenborg had, that from the time of the Lord, the better Christians that understood and knew what was going on, they become part of this, because everything comes first. Everything has a spiritual origin. So we really can't have an Operation Bootstrap. I'll pull a Pop Wolf. I'll sit down for a minute, and then you can think of your thoughts and what you might want to share. I mean, you don't necessarily. I'm not so much a person used to the idea of question and answer kind of thing, but more of dialogue. So if anybody has any interesting thoughts, they just want to, that were triggered by things. or uninteresting. We do have a lovely day. We could just Lee, microphone, please. That'll help my tape.
Somebody's got to say something.
Don't have to, but I'm happy if you do.
Okay, I'll speak for myself. I've got to say something. Just a little comment on the very beginning of your lecture, where you were talking about how they're trying to decide whether John, in fact, wrote these things, and they think maybe he didn't because of the chronology involved, and that maybe John's lifetime didn't overlap the events that he was supposed to be foretelling. And I always get a kick out of the idea that in secular biblical scholarship, it's assumed that there can't be any real prophecy. That if somebody writes about certain events, they must have been writing after those events took place, because of course nobody could know beforehand that things were about to take place. And I compare that with some rather surprising statements in Swedenborg about angels. We know that there's a debate about whether God has knowledge of what we call the future, but I think there's a pretty good case that could be made that God sees all time, past, present, and future, as one. But even the angels seem to have some level of knowledge of the future, which is a little bit surprising because they do live with something analogous to time, where there things happen before and now and after, and they're aware of that. But Swedenborg talks about they have a perfect recollection of the past, and also, I'm not sure the exact language, but something along the lines of a perfect sense of the future. And so even the angels seem to have some sense, maybe not a clear vision, of future events, perhaps based on their knowledge of patterns and realities that where the present leads to the future. And so I guess I just have to question this biblical scholarship that assumes that any time something is talked about in the Bible, that must have been written after it took place. Perhaps that's true in many instances, but I wouldn't be ready just to throw John out the window as the author of some of these things simply because secular scholars have said that those things didn't happen yet. He couldn't have known about them, therefore he couldn't have written them.
Well, there's three views or four. One is that they only know what's going on at the time. Another one is that they do know. And I thought you were going to share about the idea of numerology. There's a certain numerology that you take the name Nero Caesar and take the, if you take the consonants and assign them a numerical value, you get up to 666, and that may or may not mean anything. Certainly people can pay their money and take their choice. I'd want to look carefully at the angel's knowledge of the future. I would question that. But certainly it could leave it open. And I'm just saying, you know, that I take a look at the scholarship and I make a conclusion, and nobody has to follow the same conclusion, but most accepted scholarship dates it at 96. But there are others that can argue. Either way, what Swedenborg does, which I think is fascinating, is Swedenborg knew all about the scholarship. The fact that most biblical critics, critic in the best sense, like literary criticism, have the idea that real history begins with Abraham or perhaps with one or two generations previously. And Swedenborg knew that. He said, a lot of people talk about the mythologizing and remythologizing of the Old Testament, the first 11 books of the Bible. Swedenborg went along there. But he looked at it from the standpoint of the connected inner sense. But he treated the Bible as received text. In other words, he looked at it for its spiritual meaning. And I think he probably had as much fun as anybody else did with trying to figure out who did it. We simply don't know who wrote it. We just don't know. But if you look at, not if you, but I mean, those who Those who are gifted to look at language, vocabulary, syntax, allusions, styles of writing. And you could certainly say, well, sure, a person developed a different vocabulary as time went on, or they started to talk a little bit differently, and I think all of us do. But people look at it from that standpoint, and they think it's pretty unlikely that someone wrote all five items. And a person is, however, a person is certainly free to you know, pay their money and take their choice and say, yeah, there was John. But John was such a common name, it's hard to know who John was. And in a sense, it doesn't matter because we're taking him as a prophet, a testifier, someone who gave the word. Thank you for jumping into the void. Anybody else? You want to give Ken the...
Well, I was... the thing about John, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't he the youngest of the disciples? So I'm thinking him in...
Oh, there's a lot of reasons why you could... If he was very young and the persecution didn't take place late, then yeah, it could be the same person.
I just was... Also, the whole symbolic aspect of the Book of Revelation, that the seven cities where the letters were written, that opening passage has the lampstands representing the seven cities and the Lord in the midst of them. And I think that's just a very dynamic image. It opens up the Book of Revelation right in the beginning, just clearly stating how symbolic this is and the ways in which it can be perceived. And the idea that these are seven churches, seven different kinds of people, but also seven different dynamics within each and every one of us, with the Lord at the center of that. I think that's such a beautiful image and so useful.
There's a place where he talks that these letters are written to the angels of the church, and that the angel really it's addressed. It's also kind of from the society of the church. He's seeing these churches as having their spiritual origin.
Even you might even say to the spirit of the church.
Yeah.
Maybe to the messenger of the church.
Could be.
Could be a runner.
Could be. Swedenborg talks about the stars and the as being the societies that are behind the churches. Nothing, if we take the Swedenborg's principle that there's nothing in this world that doesn't have a spiritual origin first, then that could be the societies or the angels. That, you know, I mean, these churches didn't just end up where they started. They had people came and there were people. Came in and died, and their spirits go on living. And Swedenborg's idea is that, you know, I mean, it didn't just, the idea of a spirit living forever didn't happen just suddenly in the 1700s AD. It was forever. It just was becoming aware of it. So these people that were there that have concern, you know, I would imagine there'd be, you know, like Freiburg, Maine, there's probably a lot of people that... came to the Freiburg New Church Assembly and have passed on to the higher life, and they're still very much concerned about what we're doing here, I think. So Swedenborg and the Lord sees everything as one. The only difference is they don't have... Well, thank you very much.